The earth started as one big rock and soil did not exist. And without soil, you can't really grow trees or any crops whatsoever. Microorganisms made these rocks into soil. And it took thousands, millions of years to create soils like we have them today. And with the way we're farming today, we're actually plundering that bank account. So we are depleting soils super fast. And it is predicted that in less than 25 years, 90% of our soils will be degraded. We as humans, we can destroy things in a couple of years that have taken thousands or even millions of years to form. So in one snap of a finger, we can destroy so much work. That's an observation that I've seen in all biomes, and that's pretty scary. On the other hand, nature also regenerates pretty fast. It heals itself. And if humans help this healing process, its healing can even go faster.
My guest today, Louis de Jager, has spent years traveling the world, witnessing firsthand the decline of nature. He is an eco-entrepreneur, a landscape designer, co-founder of the Food Forest Institute, and a leading voice in the regenerative agriculture and food forest movements. He's founded numerous ventures aimed at creating positive impact and has created over 100 food forest sites around the world. His new book, SOS, Save Our Soils, How Regenerative Food and Farming Will Save Your Health and the Planet, asks us to consider every meal as a vote for either destruction or regeneration. Louis de Jager, welcome to One Planet Podcast and the Creative Process.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Yes, and so we're happy to discuss your book, Save Our Soils, to the Food Forest Institute, but I think it's helpful to ground those who may have heard these terms but not quite familiar with, you know, food forests, agroforestry, regenerative agriculture, permaculture. Just unpack some of those terms for our listeners to fully help us understand.
Yeah, it can be confusing to hear all these labels or words, but they actually come back to the same thing, and that is the regeneration of land. So the earth started as one big rock and soil did not exist. And without soil, you can't really grow trees or any crops whatsoever. Microorganisms made these rocks into soil, and it took millions of years to create soils like we have them today. And with the way we're farming today, we're actually plundering that bank account. So we are depleting soils super fast. And it is predicted that in less than 25 years, 90% of our soils will be degraded. So that's 90%. And that is really alarming because I like to have food. And I guess you like food too. Everybody needs food to survive. So in 2050, that might be a problem if we don't change the way we handle the soil. So what do we have to do instead? Instead of extracting things, we have to build the soil. And there are different techniques and ways of gardening or agriculture that build the soil. One of the most well-known techniques is organic farming. But it got a label and got rules. People also started to hollow out those rules. So there is very good organic farming. And some people are also like doing a little bit of extractive organic farming. And then you have biodynamic farming, which farms together with the phases of the moon, works more energetically. A lot of these things are actually scientifically proven right now, but for some it sounds esoterically. But the nice thing with biodynamic farming is that they use zero pesticides, never ever. They only use plant preparation. So for me, if I could choose only one type of food, it would be biodynamic. And you can see it with the Demeter label. And then, of course, you have permaculture, agroecology, regenerative, organic, and they basically are brothers and sisters from each other.
Yeah, and that statistic about the soil infertility seems like a lot, but if you're losing like 0.3% a year in 100 years, it adds up quickly. So it's really serious. Luckily, we do have these movements, the regenerative, as you say, there's a lot of labels, but they're all kind of family members.
Yeah.
The thing is to avoid the more industrialized, or if you're going to scale it up, then that's other questions. How do you scale up these things? I do want to go into how many projects you've done so we can get an idea of scale, you know, because the agricultural industry is large. So on the other end of it, how many in acreage, you know, what are we looking at in terms of the regenerative end, the food forestry end? But your work bridges the theoretical and the practical, like permaculture itself. Mm-hmm. You're helping people design functional, self-sustaining systems. So having traveled the world and witnessed these diverse environments, not just in temperate zones, but also tropical zones or deserts, mm-hmm. what's the most profound observation that you just made about the universal applicability of permaculture design for food, forestry design principles across different biomes and cultures? Where do you see those core patterns repeating, even with vastly different flora and fauna?
Well, core patterns, things that really struck me were first that we as humans, we can destroy things in a couple of years that have taken thousands or even millions of years to form. So in one snap of a finger, we can destroy so much work. That's an observation that I've seen in all biomes. And that's pretty scary. On the other hand, it's also nice to see that nature also regenerates pretty fast. It's inherently that, for example, if you make a cut in your finger, in a week, that cut will normally will be gone because your body will self-heal. And it's an amazing property we humans have, but it's also an amazing property that nature has. It heals itself. And if humans help this healing process, its healing can even go faster. Now, we have some limiting factors, and a big limiting factor is water. The more water you have, generally, the easier the healing can go. For example, if you go to the south of Spain or to the Sahara Desert or to deserts in the United States or in Australia, their regeneration goes much slower because there is less water, and you need water to build these carbon-like structures that will go into the soil and create these underground cities full of microorganisms, full of fungi, of bacteria. They need this infrastructure to live in it. They have a hard time living in dead dirt. So you need water to do that. And also you have several different strategies to regenerate land. For example, more in temperate climates, you can really go ahead and plant trees and plant cover crops. But if you go to very dry or brittle environments, planting stuff is not always a good idea. And most of the time need animals to regenerate the land. And that's for some people difficult because they know a certain climate and they think, oh, well, here you don't need animals and you can have a veganic farm if you would like to. But to have a veganic farm in, let's say, savanna in Africa would be very difficult because you need the animals to help to regenerate the land. And so every context is very different. But yeah, to come back to the main patterns that you were asking for is that once you go in a spiral, if it goes upwards, you can really go upwards fast. But if you go downwards, it can also go downwards fast. So we as a society collectively really need to choose, well, are we going to go in an upward spiral or in a downward spiral? And currently, we are going in a downward spiral, but we can stop this.
So the kind of downward spiral is like the Dust Bowl effect. Mm-hmm. And we're going through things like that in different parts of the world that we don't always hear about it. So that's interesting because you said, of course, we need water. But in some of these like tropical or very arid areas, I said, oh, it's most effective maybe. That's the place where you want to put food forests. I don't know, in terms of getting carbon out of the atmosphere because you have fast growth, mm-hmm. but then you can suffer from not having enough water. So that's interesting how the animals are also helping bring that nitrate into the soil, giving the essential nutrients. So I guess there's two approaches, and you've done that. I mean, you're in Europe, you're in Belgium, and a lot of your projects are in Europe, but just give us an overview of those different areas. You also traveled for your book to talk to people.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Well, I've been very lucky to be able to travel the world for work as well. So I run a landscape architecture firm called Commensalist, and we design properties going from very small gardens to entire islands. Most of our work is in Europe. Belgium, Netherlands, Luxembourg, France, Spain, Portugal, also the Azores Islands. We're doing a very nice hotel project over there. But we're also working abroad, so on other continents. A very interesting project is an entire island we are doing in Argentina, an island that has been completely depleted. It's been overgrazed. There was an ecological collapse, so we're now regenerating that island. It's very nice to see again that when you take away the causes of degeneration and you start regenerating, in 1 year you can already see the difference. So that's super nice to see. I've also done a lot of research for other projects in the United States, in Central America. I traveled through all the Central American countries. So I've been to the rainforest in Brazil. We're also making a documentary called Eat More Trees, which is all about the need to eat more products that come from trees. In order to plant more trees, we need to eat more trees. And it's just amazing to see the richness of the Amazon and the crazy connections, the ecological connections that I will probably never be able to understand in my lifetime. And I don't know if anybody will ever understand all those connections between the animals and the plants. I think only the indigenous people are so tuned in with all those connections. But also Indonesia, I've been there to watch the systems over there. Also know that there's a lot of degradation being done in Indonesia. And the same with Africa. I visited Morocco. There actually, when I was in Morocco, I realized or had this aha moment and said, okay, I want to do anything in my power not to have this desertification continuing. Because in Morocco, I was in the desert and I'm a forager, so I can survive in the wild if I want to. Not that I will like it. I'd rather go to a restaurant than have very high caloric food. But I can forage. And when I was in the desert, I really felt unease and I didn't know why until I realized, oh, darn it, there's nothing to eat here. I won't survive here if I was dropped in this desert. And then I learned that it didn't used to be a desert. It was a giant lush food forest. And then remnants of that food forest. So this beautiful palm trees with underneath pomegranates, some citrus, little donkeys, a little stream in between. It was like very, very romantic, but also very productive at the same time. And then I lived in the south of France as well. I spent also a lot of time in Spain. We also have projects in Spain. And there I saw that in Spain is becoming a desert. The same in the south of France or the entire Mediterranean region. It's turning into a desert. I was living in the Minervois, famous for its wine. Every summer there, we saw all the people of the village gathering a place. And then we know, oh gosh, what's happening now? And then we went and followed all the villagers. And we were all standing there together watching an entire hill that's on fire. And it was apocalyptic. And yesterday in the news around the same region where I lived, there is like thousands of hectares that were burned down again. And yeah, it's just pretty scary to see that it's getting closer and closer to almost anywhere. Even in the Arctic, there has been fires, wildfires. So the earth is talking to us and we better listen.
Exactly. And on the one hand, Spain's known for its agriculture as well. So is this partly to do with monocultures, obviously climate change? When you talk about eat more trees, I mean, there is that distinction. We don't think about it so much between annuals and perennials. And so what's wonderful when you can tap into it, and I delved more into the food forestry concepts, is that we don't have to cultivate the land. Of course, we help foster a thriving agriculture. But by relying more on these perennials, the trees and various plants, but we've over the years gone towards the annuals, but it requires a slight change to our diet because you're saying we're not used to foraging. Mm-hmm. You know, our agriculture is based upon often monocultures, even as you talk about organic farming, some of that's industrialized. So it is a monoculture, even though it's organic, but it's produced in that kind of industrialized way. So on the one hand, how do we tap into it? I mean, is it possible to make all of our agriculture, regenerative agriculture? I mean, it'll take a lot of re-education, but it also requires us to kind of change our diet if we were to rely on this more food forestry model. Mm. It's what we eat, but it's a whole way of life, I think, to get used to that. I mean, I don't know how to forage.
Yeah, there are different ways actually to get there. When you look at the history, we used to be hunter-gatherers, and that was actually one of the best times to live for several reasons, because people were very healthy, they were very well-fed, and they didn't have to work a lot to get their food. They actually got their food pretty easily. They just literally foraged or hunted. But then we became agriculturists, and the historians and archaeologists saw big differences of our health declining. Because we were eating less diversity. We were eating like mostly, for example, let's say one grain and mostly that. We were working very hard on the field. We had to work way harder to get the same amount of food. So we had bone deformities because of our bent backs and stuff like that. We also lived close together with animals. So we got a lot of disease. And also, and that's maybe a funny or strange thing to say, people who were less able got the chance to reproduce as well. Before, they weren't able to allow in the group. So it was a bit fascistic as well, let's say, during the hunter-gatherers, because if you were weak, you were simply left behind. And so this way, we grew as a species like a little bit weaker, let's say. But on the other hand, also more empathetic. I think we got more empathy, which is a very good thing. We got more empathy and we started to create culture, which is fantastic. I wouldn't want to live in a world without culture. I love to go to the cinema, listen to music, read books, watch a good series, use technology, because that also came with the agricultural revolution. And we went into a direction of more and more efficiency until a point that when you drive now through vast areas of land that you can have giant monocultures. So monoculture is like giant fields of only one crop and in nature that doesn't exist. So having a monoculture actually begs pests and diseases to come and eat everything. You're also depleting the soil by doing that. So if we want to go to back to being a foraging nation, in a modern world, it is perfectly possible to integrate that in the way we have food today. It's perfectly possible to even eat more trees without knowing it. For example, a lot of people eat bread, pizzas, cookies, and that's mostly made with grain, with wheat, flour made from wheat. But if you would like only change 1% or 5% of the bread ingredients of the wheat, for example, to chestnut flour, nobody even will taste it, but it will create millions of extra hectares or acres of chestnut trees, of forests. So you could sneak it into our food. The same with sugars. You can take sugars that come from trees instead of annuals. The same with oil. You can take oil that come from perennials, so plants that live more than 3 years, to put that into your diet. And people won't really notice it, but you will see an explosion of trees. And you could argue and say, well, isn't that a bit naive? Like sneaking it in our food, isn't that impossible? Well, the funniest thing is they did that with corn, with maize in the United States. If you go to a Walmart in the United States and go to processed foods, almost everything is full of corn starch or high fructose corn syrup or another derivative of corn. So it's a bit like biodiesel, like so much percent is perennial. So that's one side of it. Another side of it is, of course, very cultural, and it's like really changing your diet. And that is harder to do because we're so used to doing the same things. My parents did it that way. My grandparents did it that way. So I'm going to do the same. And my identity is also very much connected to what my grandmother cooked for me. That's the reason also why in some countries where they try to diminish the consumption of meat, they have such a difficulty because it's really a cultural thing and identity for people. So they have a hard time. But there, the nice thing is that with inspiration, you can quickly change the diets with people. For example, Belgium, the very tiny country where I'm from, nobody was eating sweet potatoes. Nobody. Maybe some people who are more alternative. But then they had these famous TV chefs that started to cook with them. And now today, everybody cooks with it. So in a very short amount of time, people can change their diets by making it easy. And I like the example of chestnuts because it's so versatile. I was, for example, in the United States in Route 9 Cooperative, and there I tasted chestnut beer, chestnut pancakes, chestnut donuts, chestnut pain au chocolat, chestnut coffee, like anything you could dream of made from chestnuts. In the Netherlands, I tasted chocolate without cacao, but made from chestnuts by a type of fermentation. Emil van der Staak, he's a very famous plant-based chef, and he let me taste it. I'm a huge chocolate lover, and I couldn't believe it that it was made from chestnuts. So, and that's only the chestnut. There are like, yeah, hundreds of other tree-based products that you can then, like from every fruit or leaf or stem, you can make at least like hundreds of other products. So we are living in such a poor world, actually, and there is so much more richness that we can tap into.
I think that there are obviously limitations in terms of how we have to adapt our systems. Maybe you can go in a little bit more granularity in what a food forest, say on scale, right? I'm not talking about a small, do it in my
backyard or something, you know, but that can feed a population, right? How that works in terms of, I mean, you have to kind of educate the farmers or re-educate them. Maybe these are things that they would have known before, but we have to remember these skills, because I've heard that it takes a lot of planning in the beginning. Yeah. And then after that, it can yield more, what you're saying. Maybe not the one crop, and it's not crops because it's all mixed together. As you say, you have the trees, the canopy, the producing trees, the plants. You have this whole ecosystem. But it can yield more, maybe not through the individual crop. But then that takes us, the consumer, who are so used to getting things on demand. And so it's like, I want chocolate, or I don't want chocolate with, I mean, I'm open to that. But I do not want chocolate with chestnut. I want the same chocolate that I can buy anywhere in the world, the same industrialized product.
Yeah.
So it takes a changing of mindsets. And at the same time, I would imagine also because the food is regulated, it's tested, anything in these large supermarkets, which is important, you know, so we don't poison ourselves. But in a kind of regenerative or food forestry model, if we were really to embrace that, it would be sort of like what's available then, and then the food changes according to what's seasonally available, what there is at the time. So how do we do that? How do we sneak it into our industrialized system while still having the safeguards for health, things like
Definitely.
That? Because it's important. It's obviously we're killing ourselves with our eating habits.
That's true.
It takes a lot of change from everyone involved. And especially from the consumer who needs to break the habit of wanting the same thing everywhere they go instead of finding different flavors and new experiences.
Yeah. Yeah. So first and foremost, what you're saying is that like if people want my chocolate the same everywhere, it's a bit like the Starbucks. You want your Frappuccino everywhere in the world the same. But there is something actually a little bit people happens because once gave a keynote to a very large group of coffee buyers from across the world, and they are laughing with Starbucks and they call them charbucks. Why? Because they actually almost burn the coffee beans so they become tasteless and become uniform all across the world, and they then can easily add flavors to it so it becomes the same everywhere. And it's the same, for example, with tomato paste that you buy from another famous brand. They also like very standardize it. So everywhere, and when you buy it, although they're all different tomatoes coming from anywhere, they like put the taste out of it. So that's a very sad thing, because for me, true richness is about having new experiences. And for example, saying, oh, wow, now I'm going to try this hot sauce from Brazil. Oh, now I'm going to try this hot sauce from Louisiana, and it's going to taste differently. And that's so amazing. Or if you're a Frappuccino lover, you're going to a place and say, oh, now I'm going to drink a Frappuccino of this local place, and it's so much more interesting than the other one. And you can have all this diversity. So I think this is a mindset change. And I personally believe that more and more people, and maybe also millennials, want something unique, because uniformity is boring. IT is also very bland, and it's like, okay, I'm just a number in a machine and I get the same Frappuccino every day, to keep using the Frappuccino example. But it's nice that people want something unique, and I think we would definitely need to promote that. On the other hand, when you say industrializing, for me personally, you can also industrialize regeneratively. Like all the regenerative principles that I've seen across my journeys can be scaled and can be industrialized. You can automatize it. You can have machines harvest them. And even one day having smart robots harvesting everything, humans in theory shouldn't even need to harvest anymore. One person now can easily have thousands of acres of wheat and just have one combine and one tractor and do everything it's themselves. With food forestry, the machines are not that well developed yet because the market is not that big yet. But more and more machines are being invented to harvest in these complex systems. And if you look at designing food forests, of course, there's a big difference that if you want a romantic food forest at home, which I also have, I just go out and in the morning take some berries, put it in my smoothie and drink a fantastic healthy smoothie you can find on this planet. The same one in your garden would also be as healthy. Eh? But yeah, having fresh berries, it's the healthiest you can get, and more healthy than any supermarket for any price. So that's a nice thing. But if you look at farming scale, it's not a bad thing to have it orderly in rows and make sure it's easily harvestable, because I've been to the Amazon rainforest and it's not possible to fill supermarket shelves with food coming from there, because it's not a rational plant. It's for people who live there and can harvest it themselves. But if you want to have an entire food system and distribution system, then you need to take the best principles from the Amazon rainforest, for example, and put them in rows. And you can actually achieve as much biodiversity or even more by having these complex agroforestry systems. You can have even more trees per acre or per hectare than you would have in a natural forest. And you can make more profit with those kind of farms than with a regular monoculture farm. I've been to one of those in Brazil called Fazenda da Toca. And there you can beautifully see that. And those principles are applied in any climate, ranging from tropic to subtropic to more temperate climates, and also to Mediterranean climates.
So what kind of acreage are you looking at in that farm in Brazil? Just to give people a real idea, because I want them to know it's possible and maybe they'll try it on a different scale. Because I know that in the temperate zones there are, but when you have that label, when it's regenerative, you can make more money. But is it just because it's more rare at the moment, or is it actually more total yield? I'm just thinking the way people think.
It's a very, very important question. Because to answer your first question, I think Fazenda da Toca was about 50 hectares of that agroforestry system, so 50, on a total farm of, I think, was it 1,000, 2,000 hectares in total that they are planning to scaling that up. So that system can easily be scaled up into 10,000s of hectares, even millions of hectares, easily, without any problem. Regarding the economy of scales and having it sold as a premium, the nice thing about regenerative, and I love to use the term regenerative organic, because regenerative is sometimes used as a greenwashing term as well, but if it's regenerative and organic, then it's very clear what it is. Actually, it's cheaper for the farmer. Why? Because the farmer needs to give less inputs to get as much output, maybe a little bit less output, sometimes more output. But the inputs, they can diminish by lowering their pesticides needs or their fertilizer needs. It's incredible how much money they save. I often like to give the example of a farmer I know that can buy a Mercedes-Benz every year, or now an electric Mercedes every year, just by the money he saves by using less pesticides and fertilizers, because he doesn't plow the land anymore. He still uses pesticides, unfortunately, but it's already half of the pesticides less. So it is already going into a better direction. Farmer is also always going to look at the financial side of it. And when you can convince a farmer and say, look, this guy can buy a Mercedes every year with the money he saves on pesticides, then he's going to listen, or she's going to listen. And that's an inspiring part, because farmers are also struggling financially in a lot of parts of the world, where they say, well, look, only the last ton of produce that I sell, I get my profit on. So if I have this last ton less, then I don't make a profit at all. And so their margins are super tiny and they're under a lot of stress. But if you make your input and your costs as low as possible, then it's much easier to get a profit.
Yeah, I mean, I did mention the profit motive, because that's how you're going to inspire the people who are making the food, who are buying the food for their supermarkets or other venues. But on the other hand, it's just healthy for everyone all around. It's healthier for the planet to have fewer pesticides. And then, you know, given the alarming research on herbicides like Dikwat, which is banned in several countries due to their harmful effects on gut bacteria and potentially links to diseases like Parkinson's. And of course, that then has the herbicides and pesticides impacting bee populations. So we have both, you know, our soil is going infertile and our bee populations we're poisoning them as well. Mm-hmm. So there's something that we have to do. And if it just makes economic sense, that's just wonderful to hear, because we have to look after everyone, not just our own dietary needs, because it's all symbiotic.
It's all connected.
So most of your projects, though, are in Europe, and a lot of our listeners around the world will be in temperate zones. And so just tell us a little bit about different kind of inspiring projects you've been involved in or visited or heard about.
I think one of the most inspiring projects is a combination between annuals and perennials, because I also am 100% convinced that a healthy combination is the best way to go. Because let's say that in the entire world now is fed by perennials, so trees and shrubs. If there is a hurricane or another bad weather event and it destroys all your trees, and you have to wait 15 years before you have a new walnut plantation, let's say, before they fruit again, then you will have 15 years without food. So having trees takes longer and it takes a long-term mindset. Having annuals, it can go very fast. So you plant a seed today and in a couple of months you will have your harvest. So we need the annuals, which are the sprinters, and we need the perennials, who are the marathon runners. And also they give to the soil. They shed their leaves. They get nutrients from deep down. They stop erosion. They stop the wind. They even stop disease coming in. So it's like this perfect combination between annuals and perennials that we really need. And one of the most inspiring places that I saw is Tolhurst Organic. Ian Tolhurst, it's a farmer near London, about 1 hour, 1 hour and a half from London, near the Thames River. And he has combined this agroforestry, these trees, with annuals, with vegetables, the most delicious vegetables. The crazy thing about his farm is that he hasn't imported a single gram of manure or fertilizer from outside. And he doesn't even have his own animals. So he's a veganic farm. What makes it interesting is that the mindset of agronomists, and if you go to farming school, where I went to as well, you learn that if you take something out, you need to put something in. But that's totally wrong, because the earth is a perpetuum mobile. You can take as much out without having to put anything back in. Why? Because you have an eternal supply of nutrients based in the rocks of the earth. The earth didn't have any soil. It started out as a rock. It was the fungi, the bacteria, and the plants together that created soil by grinding up these rocks. So the only thing you have to do as a farmer is make sure that you have the right environment for the microorganisms. So these microorganisms keep on doing their work and keep on mining the rocks that are in the soil, keep turning mineral content into organic content. And Ian Tolhurst is exactly doing that. So instead of fertilizing his land, what does he do? He takes a bit of wood chips he creates from his rows of trees next to his fields or between his fields. And he uses it not as fertilizer, but as an inoculation for the soil. So he inoculates the soil, giving it just this little kickstart. So the fungi and the bacteria say, all right, we can go again for a couple of more years. What he also does is he uses a lot of in-between crops, biomax, cover crops or green manures, depending how you want to call them. And what do they do? A plant actually creates something from nothing. So plant gets water from the soil, H2O, and takes CO2 from the air, from the atmosphere. It's very crazy, but taking something you can't see and putting it together with water, CO2 plus water, it gives you sugars. So it's one of the most incredible things on this planet. I think it's miraculous. CO2, something you can't see, with water, gives you sugars. And that sugars are pumped by those plants into the soil. It's like the ingredients of pancake dough that the plant creates, like the sugars, the fats, the proteins. It like pumps it into the soil. And it's sometimes up to 40% of the nutrients that a plant makes for themselves that it gives to the soil for free. And that's if you have a cover crop with all different kind of plants, different botanical families. They're pumping all kind of stuff into the soil and it feeds the soil immensely. Of course, the fungi and the bacteria that will, in exchange of these delicious pancakes, will mine other stuff and give it back to the plants. And then it will create more biomass, the plants will die. And before you know it, you have an entire new soil layer. And to me, that's total different mindset to think about gardening, growing a food forest or farming.
Hi, my name is Luke Collins. I'm a student at the University of Texas at Austin, studying philosophy and interdisciplinary liberal arts. During the fall of my sophomore year, I took a class on climate change taught by a truly brilliant environmental law professor. One of the most profound through lines in that class was the concept of destruction. When you hear the word destruction, you probably imagine a tornado ripping a home from its foundation, a bomb decimating an apartment building, a car being swept away by floodwaters, or a bridge collapsing in an earthquake. These are clear examples of destruction that agree with the most common definition of the word, which is the action or process of causing so much damage to something that it no longer exists or cannot be repaired. But in all of those examples, the objects being destroyed are man-made. A car is relatively easy to destroy, it's fragile. But nature is different. Nature is dynamic, persistent, stubborn, adaptive, and self-perpetuating. When we cut down a tree, we don't typically say we've destroyed it, because a few weeks later we might see a sprout emerging from the stump, or a seedling poking through the soil nearby, which is not to say we should go out and cut down random trees, by the way. So when we talk about the destruction of an ecosystem, we're referring to something far deeper, the breakdown of the very foundation of nature's resilience, the substrate upon which everything depends, namely the soil, as Louis de Jager has powerfully articulated. Nature isn't destroyed by a single event or isolated action, but it can be destroyed by prolonged, unnatural processes like reckless human practices. Modern agriculture, for example, prioritizes uniformity, efficiency, and maximization. These are distinctly human concepts. They don't appear anywhere in nature's vocabulary. And that, as de Jager so clearly demonstrates, is the critical point. It isn't planting, plowing, or harvesting in themselves that are destructive, but the repeated and prolonged use of certain methods without rest or renewal. Even fire, which is often seen as inherently destructive, has been used for thousands of years by indigenous peoples around the world to return nutrients to the soil and promote biodiversity. These, quote, prescribed burns, unquote, are only beneficial, however, when the land is given enough time to absorb and make use of the nutrients. It's a beautiful example of this cycle of loss and rebirth that underpins everything on our earth. De Jager reminds us that if we want a truly resilient and sustainable relationship with nature, if we want the soil, the plants, and the trees to keep meeting our needs, we have to recognize that nature has needs too. We have to develop techniques like regenerative organic farming that can be implemented repeatedly and over long periods of time that don't sicken the soil, that protect the hidden cities of microorganisms upon which we all depend. Ultimately, nature has done enough adapting. It's time for humans to return the favor. And now, back to the podcast.
Yeah, that's really the definition of regenerative. You know, just give it the fuel it needs to get started. And it goes against that ancient agricultural knowledge that we had forgotten through the, you know, relying on the industrial models. Because Rachel Carson's work highlighted this silent spring brought about by chemical interventions. And just all the things that they were losing. I mean, we've only just really started to think again about the richness of what's in the soils, those microbial networks that are just so essential. So, I don't know, it was just wrong thinking that pesticides might, I don't know, in some way increase yields for a temporary, for just a short amount of time. Mm-hmm. But after that, it just starts killing the very thing that we're eating off of.
Yeah.
So what for you is that single most like alarming, like, consequence of the industrial agriculture's impact on, you know, the soil biodiversity that we just don't fully grasp?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's an interesting question and also an intense question. It's also the question, what keeps you awake at night? So first, when somebody asked me that question, what keeps you awake at night? I was thinking nature, soil, all getting depleted, all moving. But then I realized that the thing that I really can cry about if I focus too much on it is the human condition. If you look on this planet, so many people are dying of hunger, malnutrition, but also in affluent countries. If you look at the United States, for example, it's crazy how many people are obese, but also malnourished at the same time. And one of the most scary consequences of our diet and the way we live is that one in every three persons has a chronic disease. A chronic disease is something that should not exist, that people should not have. I talk to a lot of doctors about chronic disease and they all say it should not exist. We don't even understand why it should exist, but it does exist. And the reason is the food we eat. So one in every three persons, that's enormous. And then another alarming thing for me personally is that one in every four persons is taking antidepressants or taking sleeping pills. So if you meet four persons tonight, then one of those people is taking antidepressants or sleeping pills. It's worrying. It's the biggest pandemic that I've ever heard. And for me, That is the worst consequence there is. Health and happiness are the basics of everyone. Like, we have clients all across the world, going from billionaires to average people, left wing to right wing, religious, non-religious, but they all agree on the same thing. They want their kids to be healthy and happy. They themselves, they want to be healthy and happy. And that's why I really am very hard on this. But every discussion where health and happiness is not on the center of that discussion is, in my opinion, not a discussion, but a fantasy. And that's why I really try to bring every discussion that I'm involved with, if I talk with politicians or in groups, I say, where is happiness and health? Is that included in your discussion? No. Why not? No, we're talking health and happiness. That's the only thing that matters. That's the only thing.
Yes, and they're so integrally linked. And so when you're talking about these chronic diseases, these are diseases based on inflammation. So we've been discussing a lot of plant life and fruiting trees. It's also because of the animals we eat as well. If we do eat animals, they're giving us through their diet, which are these grains, it's that imbalance between the omega-3s and the omega-6s. We need to put that in the correct balance because it's causing, by eating those animals that are not fed off grass, we're killing our microbiomes, but it's also that imbalance between the omega-6s and the omega-3s that is causing that inflammation, like the cancers and so many things. So one, maybe don't eat animals, that would be a good idea. But if you are, eat healthy animals or find out what they're eating. And as you said, it can be part of a regenerative system.
Yeah. I personally don't eat animals myself, but I don't have anything against people who do. Because you can also be very healthy and eat animals at the same time. It's just like if you look at the industrial system where people grow animals, it's full of antibiotics, full of other chemicals. And that's horrible for your own health. That's also one of the reasons I stopped eating meat. It all starts and ends with our gut health. Our gut health, it's called our second brain. Our brain is connected with our gut. It's called the brain-gut axis. And if you talk about chronic diseases, then chronic diseases mainly starts in your gut or can be healed with a healthy gut. And the same with happiness. 90%, that's 90% of your happiness hormone, serotonin, is created in your gut. So all your happiness is literally created in your gut. So if you have the antibiotics via the meat you eat or even via the plants you eat, because they use animal manure on those fields that are full with antibiotics, it comes in your plant as well and it enters your mouth. These chemicals and pesticides, they might not kill your human cells, but we as a human, we exist of more non-human cells than human cells. So we are not even human. We're like this vehicle full of microorganisms. And yeah, it might be shocking for some people, but a fungicide that kills a fungus on the field will also kill the fungus in your body that's keeping you healthy. So yeah, the food you eat and also the meat you eat, it will affect your gut health. If you eat shitty food, you'll have a shitty gut, and a shitty gut won't produce your happiness hormone. And if you don't have a happiness hormone, you'll become unhappy. And then you have to take pills. And that's, of course, fantastic for people selling pills, but not for you.
Yeah, exactly. And we can often have these cravings for the sugar, for the fats, for the industrialized melange of, I don't even know, you look at the packet of food, sometimes you can't identify the food because there's so many chemicals and colorants that come before it.
You need a chemistry degree.
Yeah, you really do. But the thing is, we need to regenerate our mindset, because then we'll crave those other foods. We'll crave something that actually regenerates us and is actually good for us. So, you know, I'm just wondering, looking ahead beyond, I mean, I don't even know what percentage of farming is regenerative organic, but looking ahead, let's say we get there. Let's say we use even robots to scale it up. As mm-hmm. you say, they get better, they're getting better. So looking ahead 50, 100 years, you know, and we do get to return our soil fertility, what might that look like?
Yeah, I'm 100% sure that we can get there, and it's not super hard to do so. And I often compare it with a roof that is leaking and with buckets that we're putting under the leaks of that roof. Right now, we have so many leaking roofs and a giant bucket industry. So you have people that make the buckets, that bring the buckets to your home. You also can pay people to empty the buckets. And that's an entire industry, people that empty the buckets of your leaking roof. And the bucket industry doesn't really want you to fix your roof, because if your roof is fixed, the entire bucket industry will collapse. And that's exactly what's going on. A healthy human body doesn't need medication, only in a worst case scenario, only if you have like a bad disease or something. But normally you don't really need it. Most of our little pains or ailments, you can drink some herbal tea or take a tincture or something very simple, like a thing your grandmother could have made for you. Like most things can be solved that way. It's the same with the soil. If you have a healthy soil, you don't really need any pesticides or fertilizers or chemicals. And that's the interesting thing. It's always very funny to see a scientist that say, oh, wow, I developed a genetically modified crop that can now grow on very bad soil. Then I'm like, wow, first of all, congratulations and respect for that you've created that crop. But have you spent your energy doing the right thing? Couldn't you have spent that energy in maybe healing the soil? Because why create a crop that's good growing on bad soil if you could just fix that soil? And that's just an entire mindset switch that we really need to make as a human species, is to fix the source of the problem and not just the symptoms. But that's exactly what we're doing with our own body. I see people taking pills for their headache, and then it creates problems for their stomach. Then they need to take pills for their stomach. And before you know it, I know pills that people that take pills every day for everything and all the side effects of all the things, instead of maybe it was a hormonal imbalance, or maybe it was the liver that had a problem. But people see, oh, you have like a little spot on your skin, let's take that spot away. But that spot on your skin comes because you maybe have a liver imbalance, or maybe something wrong with your kidney. It's the same with the soil. People are like saying, oh no, you have to add more this or add more that. But if you really look at the soil, then you just know that, well, it needs more soil life. And how do you get more soil life? Well, it's by taking care of the soil, by planting trees, by using cover crops, by not using monoculture. And the thing is, we as a human species in the future are going to focus on just creating the conditions of, for us humans and for nature, of taking care for itself. Why pay for it if you can get it for free? It's with your own health, but it's also with soil health.
Yeah. And often with, you know, a growing population on a finite planet, it comes down to a compromise. Well, an economic compromise, a compromise between respecting nature, but also having to scale it up and work with technology in order to get it to the people who need it. As you say, we have enough food on this planet, but it's an issue of transporting. We know that food and food waste is contributing to climate change, contributing to emissions. You know, not everyone will be able to live next to a food forest. So to get the food from a food forest to the consumer, most of us live in cities and increasingly in mega cities. How do we do that? So what are your thoughts on, say, vertical farms? What are those ways to bring the food next to where most of people are living, you know, as we try to balance out our emissions and everything going forward?
Yeah, when I started my journey, I was very angry at bananas coming from the other side of the world. I was thinking we all need to go locally. To be honest, I tried to buy as much local as possible. But if you look at the numbers, you see that the food mileage is not the biggest contributor of greenhouse gases. The transport is really a small part of all the problems. It's really the way you grow food. A lot of the times it's feeding livestock that is a very big part of the problem, and growing food to feed livestock. I don't have any problems of people eating cows, and the cows have been just roaming in the field and eating grass. That's a very ecological thing to do. But especially growing maize, corn or grains for cows, that's a waste of energy, of money, of fuel, of greenhouse gases, because that can be directly fed to humans. Also, cows are meant to eat grass and not corn, for example. So you're actually also making these cows sick that way. So yeah, that's the thing. But your question about how then do we transport that to cities, that's really not something that I fear about food forest products. How are we going to get it to cities? We already have fantastic transportation systems. We can use the same. We can even make that more efficient. So for me, that's not a big problem. And it's actually better to do that than, for example, to have a vertical farm, because vertical farms are super energy intensive. they mostly need to be very sterile. So having the right soil bacteria that needs to be on your food to feed the bacteria in your gut will not be present, which is a huge problem because our gut fauna or flora, depending on how you want to call it, depends on the influx of new microorganisms. And if you eat an apple or eat something that comes from a vertical farm, then it will be void of those microorganisms. So microbiology, but also just money. Land is way cheaper than vertical farming. And in cities, land is even more expensive. Infrastructure is expensive. Infrastructure can break down, which can be very volatile during crises. Imagine if Kiev in Ukraine, for example, was depending on vertical farms. Well, what's the first thing that an invader is going to do? Bomb the vertical farms and then they won't have any food and then they will all die. If there's like a power outage, then your vertical farm will also collapse. Or if there's like a disease outbreak, your entire vertical farm will collapse. So I believe that vertical farms really can play a role, like having specialty crops or very expensive, very like fragile crops. But for like bulk crops and the bigger things, it makes no sense to have those.
Right. So in the future, probably we can have the farm forests closer to our like mega cities or, you know, cities with like 8 million people. I always picture like what you said, like it's in the Amazon or, you know, I mean, these are the pictures I've seen of food forests.
Yeah, it can be done everywhere.
And so how many actual food forestry projects have you been involved in? And you've done landscaping and different things.
Yeah, well, we created a little map for our website, I think 2 or 3 years ago, and there were already more than 100 projects we did across the world. So the actual number today, I would have to recount it, but yeah, it's more than 100, maybe 120, 138, I don't know. But enough to got a lot of experience and to know what can fail, what can go good, what can go wrong. And it's also nice to work on all these different scales from literally very small gardens that are in the middle of the city to giant agricultural estates. I also really love to work with hospitality businesses, people having an ecological hotel, for example, or an ecological resort, because there are so many people that come there every year and they can all be inspired. They can all have a seed in their mind that has been planted. We're working also for people who have a yoga retreat, any kind of retreat, or also like business incentive places, because people want to have something special. And just going to a place and seeing a stupid lawn, for example, it's boring. But if they can go out and pick berries during the breaks, or if they go to a restaurant of the hotel and can taste a sauce or a cocktail that has been made from fruit from their own food forest, that's something special and unique and something you never forget. From time to time, I give these foraging tours together with people, and I've done it with poor children coming from impoverished neighborhoods, but also with top CEOs and everything in between. You can really shift their minds or even over their hearts by just having them taste things they didn't know were edible before. For example, nettles. You can eat a nettle raw. There is a special technique to roll the leaves and to eat them raw. And it's the first time you do it, it's like super scary because it feels a bit like Russian roulette, being afraid to get stung in your mouth. But when people do that, there's something that changes. And I truly believe that love goes through our stomachs, like this saying. And transformation also goes through our stomachs. And that's why I truly believe that landscape regeneration, even in your garden, it should have a large percentage of edible plants because it is ornamental as well. It's good for the climate as well. It's good for nature. And it's good for your own body because you eat the right microorganisms and like the most fresh nutrients and micronutrients you can imagine. And for me, that's really the way to go.
Yeah, I think a lot of these projects are interesting too, whether it's a hotel or a yoga retreat or different ways for people to encounter it. Then they become ambassadors. And it's really important because when you have, and it might be, I think it's really interesting. I love the name Food Forest, but sometimes I think policymakers or people or business people, that it's almost like you said, you know, why pay for something if you can get it for free? And they think, people are getting it for free.
Damn it.
Why make something if people can? It seems, yes, exactly. That's the number one rule, charge for everything.
Oxygen. Yeah, you got to tax the oxygen somehow.
Now, that's at the kind of elite end, but these transformative projects have places like, you know, in Senegal, it's transformed desertified areas like in the Middle East. So where people really need it, where the land has become infertile and dry and just is yielding nothing. So it's, let's just say, it's not just for the organic people who go to Whole Foods. It can really be transformative for the small farmer too and their livelihoods.
That's exactly the cool thing about it, that it's for a billionaire or for a very poor person, it's the same bush that's going to grow next to your door or on your balcony or even on your windowsill. It's going to be exactly the same bush and the same berry with like the best nutrition you can find. You could say, well, then a billionaire could go to a store and pay like $1,000 for a kilo of blueberries. But even that won't be as good as that bush growing outside your door. And that connects us all together. No matter which religion or political view you have, it's the same bush of berries. It's the same apple tree. And it's the best quality you can get an apple tree. You can buy an apple tree for the price of a couple of kilos of apples you would buy at the store. And once you planted that apple tree, it will give you apples for the rest of your life. So it's like the best deal you can make in your life.
The difference is night and day. I almost wonder when I compare, was it even really food? Why has it not gone off? It's been 2 months there and it still hasn't changed. Just looking towards, obviously, it's something that you really care about, our planet, our health, our happiness. What started you on this journey? I mean, who were those inspiring teachers or mentors? And what is the importance of education and getting the message out there and living a more happy and connected life?
Well, education is the most important part, because what made me really go into that direction were very regular people who were inspired by leaving the city, going to the countryside, and there starting their own permaculture paradise. And there, just visiting those people, we stayed there for a couple of nights, and just them talking about their passion, it's like they infected me with a virus that I still have in me today, which I'm very happy for, to regenerate the land, to live a more permaculture way of life. And that initial spark didn't came by a guru I saw on TV or on YouTube or somewhere else. It was just by regular people, like just sharing their passion. So we need more people who are passionate, who follow their passion, and then who just share that passion, just talk about it. Even if you meet somebody on the train, I had to share a taxi because my tram was cancelled and I had to take it with somebody else in the middle of the night because I wouldn't be able to get home, with a random guy. And we just had a chat and I talked about Food Force, of course. And that could have gave a spark to that person, and maybe he would have never heard about Food Force before, but because of a very random encounter, now he does know about it. And of course, that can be food forestry, but maybe you are very good at fermenting foods and that's all you talk about. And you can share that passion with other people. So I think that's the most important part. Of course, then after you get that initial spark, you want to learn as much as you can. And you can't see it because it's on the other side of my screen, but there's like this huge stack of books behind it by Martin Crawford, Richard Perkins. What else do I see here? Yeah, all kind of books about nuts or trees, or Masanobu Fukuoka, for example, is one of my main influencers, a farmer from Japan who wrote a book called The One Straw Revolution. Bill Mollison and David Holmgren, who founded permaculture together. These persons brought universal knowledge together in a very palatable way. And you're giving a big gift to the world to bundle your knowledge and make it palatable. And some people will do it via books, with teachings. And everybody can play a role in it. We too, we give, for example, week trainings. We give food forest design courses where people are immersed for 1 week into food forestry. They're bombarded with information at the end of the week. They've learned in 1 week to design a food forest. So you can teach yourself or be taught in 1 week like the basics of some things. So I would definitely recommend people to invest in yourself and go on that week training of, is it food forestry? Is it fermenting food? Is it building straw bale houses? Or I don't know what your passion is, but do that. I try to do it myself every year and do 1 week at least of training myself something and something new. It's the only thing that people can't take away of you. It's the only true wealth you can own. It's your knowledge and your ability to do stuff.
Yes. And in closing, as you think about the future and the next generation, what kind of world we're living for the next generation, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
I once heard the quote, don't teach people how to build a sailboat, but inspire them and tell them stories about the sea and let them long for the sea.
Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, I often say that, yes, the famous author of The Little Prince. Yes.
Voilà, exactly, you know it. I forgot it was him that said it. And it's so true. It's you want children to open as many doors for children as possible so they know all these beautiful pathways that exist. And that's, I think, maybe one of the only things that we need to do as grown-ups is just show them in an inspired way all the doors that are there. Look, this is a door. If you follow that path, you could become a doctor. If you follow that path, you could know anything about plants. Just go to that man there who lives in the forest and he'll teach you everything. And if you can plant that seed inside of them or plant a gazillion of seeds, some of them will germinate. And in some people, other seeds will germinate. But we need to, first of all, create favorable conditions for the children so they have fertile soil by making sure they grow up in a loving society, in a society where they know they can make mistakes, because making mistakes is the best way to go forward. It's called failing forward. I love that term. It's also how nature works. If a plant grows a root and it hits a rock, then it won't give up and say, oh my God, there's a rock. No, it's going to say, okay, I'm just going to grow my root around the rock. And so by creating a good atmosphere and then like planting gazillions of seeds into the minds of children, this way they'll have the space to, and also the time, so they can explore stuff. And then we have to have faith that these things will grow. And this is something we as grown-ups can help with.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for planting those trees for future generations. I think it's all about that. So thank you, Louis de Jager, for showing us how we can save our soils, how regenerative food and farming will save our health and the planet. By listening to nature, we can create a regenerative revolution and work collectively to create a better tomorrow. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet podcast and the creative process.
Happy to do that, and thanks for your nice conclusion.
The Creative Process and One Planet podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producers on this episode were Sophie Garnier and Luke Collins. One Planet podcast is produced by Mia Funk with additional production support by Katie Foster. Theme music is written and performed by Juan Sanchez. We hope you've enjoyed this program. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast and be part of the climate change solution, just follow us on Instagram on @creativeprocesspodcast and send us a DM. Thank you for listening.